This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Our top story on this show today, it's quite extraordinary regarding the chaotic state of politics in Europe. This past Sunday in Italy's general election, voters rejected mainstream politics in record numbers, and the result cast extraordinary doubt on Italy's place in the European unification project going forward. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Richard Palmer about this very prophetically significant development. We'll also cover an important story about race relations and trying to correct imbalances and inequalities among the races. This is obviously a huge topic in many circles right now. If you want to learn the direction this argument can go, look at South Africa. This was discussed some on last Friday's Week in Review program. We'll go a bit more in depth into it today. But there in South Africa, politicians are talking about land seizures from white farm owners without compensation. We'll talk with Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about this and the very damaging effects this could have on that nation. After that, we'll talk about a major factor that the media are ignoring as they report on the aftermath of the Florida school shooting from the middle of February. And I'll conclude today's show by talking about the extraordinarily fine-tuned nature of planet Earth. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. The trend of earth-shaking election results continues with Italy's recent general election. This deals yet another blow to the status quo in European politics. To talk about this, we have Trumpet writer Richard Palmer from our office in England. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
So tell us about the results of this election.
So the big takeaway is you have two fringe parties who have never before led a government in Italy's history dominating this election. Both of these two combined, these two fringe parties received just a hair's breadth under 50% of the seats in the two chambers of parliament. So you've got the position now where you've got these two parties cannot be excluded from government if you're going to have any kind of stable government. And so it really is a political revolution for Italy. You're seeing the term earthquake used just about everywhere. It's talking about these results, just a radical upheaval, even more so than what we saw in Germany for Italy's politics.
So tell us about these two parties. The one that was the most popular was the Five Star Movement. Tell us about this.
That's right. So this is this party that was founded in 2009, so after the financial crisis hit Europe and Greece started going through all those troubles in end of 2007, start of 2008. Five Star Movement comes along. It's founded by a comedian, Beppe Grillo, and it's basically a left-wing populist party. So it wants – well, they've talked a lot and they've experimented a lot with direct democracy. They've talked a lot about ending corruption. A lot of their politicians that are kind of just – more like ordinary people or a lot of young people, people brand new to politics, not the type of person that's kind of worked their way through various different positions. And because they're a direct democracy party, they may be a bit more flexible and hard to pin down because their votes just depend, just are more determined on votes by their members. But generally, they're fairly left wing. One of their platforms, for example, was a universal basic income, a very left wing, very socialist idea where everybody just gets money for being an individual. So you could maybe best bet to think of these as kind of like a new Bernie Sanders upstart party.
Right, except it does seem like the challenge to the status quo couldn't be more stark, that this is a reaction. This is basically politics as it is right now is not working. We're basically going to build something new from the ground up and just give the power to the people.
That's right. You know, we need to do something completely different. We can't even trust everyday politicians. Their politicians, for example, they have to donate half their salaries that they make to charity to try and stop people being in it for the money or corruption. If you have even just the minorest criminal infraction against you, you can't stand for the Five Star Movement. So it's a complete rejection of just the entire way of doing politics. They want a new system. They talk about smashing the system. In the past, they've ruled out doing coalitions with anybody. This time around, they've been a little more hedgy about that. But usually in Italy, people stand – coalitions kind of declare before the election. Mm-hmm. And they're not necessarily the same coalitions that end up ruling afterwards. But again, the Five Star Movement is unique because they stood alone. They weren't part of any coalition. They're just against – the political establishment and politics.
And this party, extraordinary as it is, got nearly one in three votes in this election. Most popular party in the entire election. So tell us about the second party that really won big.
So the second party is traditionally, it's been like a fringe right-wing party. They used to go by the name Liga Nord, the Northern League. And it was started out as a league of parties that were generally pretty right-wing. They wanted autonomy, if not independence, for Northern Italy. But in the run-up to this election, they rebranded themselves. So they dropped the Northern from their name and became just Liga, or just the League. And they stopped campaigning for independence for Northern Italy. They started campaigning very hard on migrants. So they're a right-wing populist party. Their leaders talked about about sending all of the migrants home. Italy's taken on 600,000 migrants over the last few years. It is becoming a major problem across, and it's causing a lot of tension across the whole country. So they've campaigned on a much more right-wing platform. There is similarity and there is overlap between these two parties, the Five Star Movement and the League. They're both very anti-EU. They're both kind of anti-immigrant as well. They both think that the euro was a bad idea and think that Germany and France are using this to really put in policies that are good for them but really hurt Italy. So some similarities, but populist on the left, populist on the right. And the Liga Nord, they're more similar, say, to the Alternative for Deutschland in Germany.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting. People are calling this, say, a political earthquake in Italy when you're talking about already a very highly unstable political environment. Italy is just notorious for having dramatic and regular turnover among politicians. And thinking about, say, the role that Italy would play in the larger picture within Europe. I mean, it is a major country. It does have a major economy and contributes to the overall power of the European Union substantially. What does this mean in terms of Italy's relationship to the rest of Europe, and how does Europe kind of manage its relationship with Italy going forward?
Yeah, it depends exactly. It depends on how the different coalitions come together, what the ultimate government looks like. But it seems like we're going to be somewhere between hostility to all-out war with the rest of Europe, the way that they're looking. I mean, you look at some of the quotes from the Liga Nord's leader. He said I think this was even after the election. He said it's no to Berlin, no to Paris, no to Brussels. Italians are going to decide for Italy from now on. He's called the euro a crime against humanity. Their economic spokesperson. I mean, basically, both the League and the Five Star Movement, they both used to campaign on a platform of bringing Italy out of the euro. Then in the French elections last year, you saw that that didn't really work. That was a big step. And so both of these parties, they say, well, the euro was a bad idea, but we're not going to campaign to leave it. Instead, what they've campaigned to do is just completely ignore all of Germany and France, or basically Germany's rules that they've put in place for euro members, ignore them and just kind of dare Germany to kick them out.
And that you were saying this about France, or this is what Italy is doing now?
This is what Italy is doing. So yeah, they learned, so, in France, you had the the National Front campaigned to go out to leave the euro, and they lost a lot of publicity that because people were just – it's a big step to quit the euro. And even though people don't like the euro, they're a little hesitant to take that step. So there's been a bit of rebranding in those parties where they've just said, well, we'll just defy Germany but remain in the euro. And you can really see how that – I mean, this is a political crisis in Italy. You've got all these other political crises, and this is where they start just feeding into each other.
Right.
Because that immediately hits the German political system. The euro is kind of the big unresolved disagreement between the two German coalition partners that are just coming together. So they don't know how to do that. At the same time, the Alternative for Deutschland got started because Germans didn't like money going to Southern Europe. Mm-hmm. And so if Italy starts spending wildly on the European credit card, saying we're going to completely ignore any attempts at restraint from Germany, we're just going to do what we want, well, then you can just see that boosting the Alternative for Deutschland support, increasing all of the problems in Germany's political system. And it's just, it kind of just all feeds into one massive conflagration.
Yeah, if you look at the problems with putting a coalition together within Germany, it seems like so much of that has to do with the conflict between the traditional parties and the, say, Alternative for Deutschland and some of the parties that many Germans are rushing to. Here you have, it seems like, more of a consensus that whatever it is that we do, we don't want it to be pro-Europe. It's this very antithetical to so much of what European leaders have been trying to build over a course of decades. And the threat to the European project and Germany in particular, what Germany is trying to build, seems very high at a time when you have very little stability politically within Germany.
Exactly. And like I said, when you've got 50% of these now votes going to these fringe Eurosceptic platforms, and then even Silvia Berlusconi's party was campaigning on a fairly Eurosceptic, I mean, they were trying to have it both ways a little bit, but Eurosceptic platform. So you're getting a lot of Italians here looking this way. And you can see why. There are parts of Italy where youth unemployment is still around 50%.
Wow.
I think Sicily, there are other European regions that are really suffering. You've got the migration problems in Germany are bad. But for Italy, again, it's even worse. They're on the front lines. Italy is where the migrants arrive. They kind of feel that the rest of Europe had promised to help, that just part of the European project meant that they should be sharing burdens on this kind of thing, and that Europe is reneging on that. So that basically Italy kind of gets hit for the euro crisis. Then when it's their turn to need help on migration, Europe doesn't step up. And so you can see why they're turning again, why they're just having so many turn against Europe now there as well.
So it's not difficult to see why so many observers of Europe, as they watch these soap operas play out, these political dramas play out in country after country, to say, you know, Europe is a mess and Europe isn't going anywhere. At the Trumpet, we say something very different, and that is that out of all of this turmoil, there is going to emerge something very strong, very powerful, that someone is going to take advantage of the disorder and turn it into order, and it'll happen very quickly. I'm thinking, looking at just what's happening here in Italy, I'm just reminded of that prophecy in Revelation 17, where it speaks in terms of this power emerging from the underground, that it's basically like there's this kind of cloud of uncertainty, and then boom, something comes up out of the middle of it. Maybe you could just talk about, obviously, there's a lot that we don't know at this point with how this is going to play out, but what sort of scenarios we might be seeing in possibilities as to how this might play out.
Well, Revelation 17, like you mentioned, really does give us the guide. And I think the prophecies there kind of do imply exactly the kind of political crisis that we see Europe going through now. It talks about about a very closely knit 10-nation power made up of 10 kings and one ruler over them. And what you have in Europe right now is 28 democracies with three presidents in this much looser union. So Revelation 17 would imply a massive and very fundamental change to the union, but also even to every nation in the union, if they're going from, you know, they're going to be led by kings, by strong autocratic rulers. So, you know, to get from where we are now to what you see in Revelation 17 implies a pretty big crisis. And I think that's what we see building here. And there's a number of different ways. I mean, one thing that we haven't really talked about from Italy is just another major trend is just also the gridlock. Like, there isn't an easy coalition coming forward now. And so you're seeing this in country after country. You know, you saw the Netherlands take months to form a government. We've seen Germany take 6 months to form a government. And even the government that they have, you know, it disagrees on, say, fundamental things about the euro. And so you could see that anytime the euro crisis flaring up, that falling apart. Italy now could well be unable to form a government. I mean, we don't know, but it may well be, and they could be facing fresh elections. People are talking about Spain's government collapsing after they're having now some political upheaval and a brand new party becoming one of the most popular. And they've got even problems keeping their own nation together. So you're just seeing political paralysis across Europe. Meanwhile, these crises are escalating. Problems are building, not just in the economy, but certainly in the economy and across all these other areas. You're seeing Eastern Europe already turning to these strong autocratic king-like leaders. So you could see that being one way that we get to Revelation 17, just all of this gridlock multiplying until, you know, people just reaching the conclusion, well, we just need a strong man in charge because our systems are broken.
Yeah, and that's a great point. I mean, you really could see looking at the overall picture within Europe, certainly there's going to be a strong man rise up and set the whole empire on course. But you would likely see the same kind of revolution happening on a microcosmic level within nations in order to produce, say, out of the chaos and the political turmoil that's happening within those countries, to have that autocratic ruler rise to the fore and be one of those 10 kings.
Yeah, and you can see exactly the same process driving both. I mean, we've talked for years about how Europe is paralyzed because it doesn't have a strong leader and it can't really make decisions, and how that's going to create a need for a strong leader. Now you're seeing the same situation at a national level across Europe, where various different nations are all becoming paralyzed with the democratic system. And so in the same way, you could see that creating this need for a strong leader. And I think that's certainly what things like Revelation 17 would imply. Mr. Fleury even has the quote where in the booklet that he wrote, "A strong German leader is imminent," talking about, well, when the Bible says a king, it generally means an autocratic leader with king-like tendencies, even if he's not maybe literally called a king.
Yeah. Well, we'll put a link to that booklet that you just mentioned, "A Strong German Leader is Imminent," in the show notes for the program today. Another booklet that listeners might be interested in is one that Richard Palmer lent quite a bit of research assistance to, "The Holy Roman Empire and Prophecy," to just get that historical view of how politics within Europe have tended to take this course in multiple times throughout history. But Richard, we've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about this election in Italy, the general election this past weekend. He has an article on thetrumpet.com called "Italy Game Over for Traditional Politics." It was the trumpet brief yesterday. Go check that out. Really fascinating stuff. And Richard, we appreciate your insights. There's a lot there to parse out, but we think really appreciate the admirable job that you did of that.
Well, thanks, and thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Issues of racial equality are hot topics in many countries today as people try to correct imbalances and inequalities between the races. Well, if you want some perspective on just how radical proposals to solve these problems can get, Look at South Africa. There's quite an alarming situation unfolding there right now. It's been over 20 years since apartheid was ended and black South Africans began to rule the country. But for many people, this has not made life better. It's actually made things worse. Last December, government policymakers announced plans to start confiscating white-owned land without compensation. And now South Africa's new president is promising to carry out that plan. To talk about this, we have Trumpet writer Andrew Miller here in the studio with us. Hello, Andrew.
Hello.
So tell us about this announcement last December.
Yeah, the announcement was made last December at a conference of the ANC, the Ashika National Congress, which is the largest party in South Africa's parliament. And they announced it was going to be official policy to start confiscating white-owned land without compensation and redistributing to blacks.
And can you tell us the logic behind it, why they would do that? What are they trying to fix by proposing this?
Right. Well, right now, they haven't done an official audit, but it's widely believed that whites own about 70% of the land in South Africa, even though they're less than 8% of the population. And so it's more like a affirmative action type thing. Mm-hmm. Under apartheid, there were rules that whites couldn't sell to blacks and blacks couldn't sell to whites. They've done away with those rules since apartheid was ended to like a, what they call the willing buyer, willing seller program, kind of like it is in America. If you sell to anyone sure. you want to sell to and has the money. But because a lot of the black population in South Africa doesn't have the money or for other reasons, they haven't been able to buy as much land as they'd like. So this is this land reform thing is like I said, well, we'll just take it without compensation. And give it to these black families and others who want it.
Okay, so they're basically just forcibly imposing a greater racial equality in land ownership, and essentially telling white landowners that your property rights don't exist under. Under these rules.
That is the type of rhetoric you're hearing from a lot of politicians. Now, they haven't officially announced how they're going to do this or even exactly if they're going to do this. The ANC has made it official policy in December. They also elected a new president, Cyril Ramaphosa, who has pledged to follow through with these demands. And they introduced he didn't introduce the motion to parliament, but the Economic Freedom Fighters, which is a radical Marxist party in South Africa, introduced a motion to parliament, which was supported by the South African Communist Party and the ANC, saying that we do want to follow through with this, taking land away from white farmers and redistributing it. Now there's a constitutional review process they have to go through to figure out if you can actually do that. Because it's not, you'd have to alter South Africa's current constitution, I think, to make that legal. And Mr. Ramaphosa has also come out and tried to calm down markets by saying that we're not going to do smash and grab confiscations. This is going to be more orderly. No word yet in exactly how the details of how he plans on doing forcible confiscations without compensation in a orderly manner.
Right. So, yeah, I guess that's really the challenge is you make the transition from, you know, the exciting political rhetoric and you're saying we're going to redistribute this land and we're going, you know, making the pronouncements in a general sense, making the transformation from that to actually getting down to how do you implement this? Whose land do you take? Who do you give it to? You know, the details of how to do this in what could under any circumstances be considered an equitable and just way. That could be a real challenge.
And some of it really, that is why this situation is so bad, is you'll commonly hear the analogy made. It was like, well, South Africa's going the way of Zimbabwe, because Zimbabwe did that starting in the year 2000, where the government stepped in and took land away from white farmers without compensation and gave it to blacks. Now their white population was substantially smaller, so the logistics it was easier. And because the government took fairly decisive action, the death toll was pretty low. There's only maybe like two dozen white farmers who were killed in the process. The rest gave up their land more or less willingly, left the country or got another job. And the agricultural sector was devastated because they took the land from the people who were used to farming it for so long and gave it to people who were novices at this. But in South Africa, you have 70, 80, 700 people, farmers murdered every year. So in some way to say South Africa is going the way of Zimbabwe is like, well, yes, if the government takes the land, that is the way of Zimbabwe. But as far as like the racially motivated violence, 1 year in South Africa is more violent than like Zimbabwe's entire history or the last several decades.
Yeah, so the people to this point, there's been sort of more of a vigilante movement to exactly this kind of a policy on a case-by-case basis rather than waiting for the government to intervene to do it.
Right, and there's the government in South Africa is really bad about giving official statistics on this type of thing. But unofficially, it looks like there's been about 119 farm attacks this year, and we're in March.
Wow.
So I know like all of them were killed, but I mean, some of the ones that are killed are some of the most brutal, brutal murders on the world scene, things that you even have to be careful saying about on the radio. But I have some contacts in South Africa. I know one of our ministers down there has talked about stories he heard about like babies being pushed into microwaves. And I did an article last August about an elderly couple who was burned alive with a blowtorch.
That's just brutal.
Yeah, so, people crucified on tables. But it's a terrorist tactic that people are using to scare white farmers from the land. And so they'll leave on their own. And now the government obviously hasn't come out and condoned these type of attacks.
Yeah, you could almost look at,
come close, but it's...
Yeah, you could almost see them justifying implementing a policy like this in using language like, well, we're trying to actually prevent it from just being happening kind of on its own in more violent ways.
Right. And some of the politicians, Julius Malema, he's the leader of the Economic Freedom Fighters who introduced this motion. But he's always been very famous for like singing the song, like bring me my machine gun and shoot the farmer. Or this week he was given a really emotional speech about how we are going to cut the throat of whiteness. And of course, he doesn't get in trouble for it because cut the throat of whiteness. Whiteness is like an abstract concept. So he can always fall back on the idea that, well, I'm speaking metaphorically. But a lot of the poor people in Shantytown who hear the speech about go cut the throat of whiteness don't view it that way. They view it as get your knife, get your machine gun, go out to a farm, kill someone and take his stuff.
Yeah.
And in his case, I think he does it on purpose. I guess I'll be careful with libel, but I don't know. I mean, I've suspected that. But in some of the other cases, like Ramaphosa, he may be more thinking that, well, we just need to take this like Zimbabwe did. So we don't have a huge murder epidemic. But if the constitutional review process doesn't allow this to happen, which I suspect will be the case, I don't think the government will go through with the policy. Might be wrong there. I think it could almost be worse in that you are going to have a vigilante movement that's already pretty horrible in South Africa, getting a lot more intense than it is right now.
Yeah, I'd like to talk more about that in just a minute. One point, you've written an article on thetrumpet.com, South African president pledges to take land from white farmers, and you go into this historical perspective. He made a comment that taking land from the indigenous people of South Africa was the nation's original sin. And you kind of go into the history to dispel that. Can you just talk about that for a bit?
Right, because there was one politician who said that the 1913 Land Act was the original sin. And that's the act where they said whites can't sell to blacks and blacks can't sell to whites. And then Ramaphosa came in and said, "Like, well, actually, the original sin goes way back before that, because why did the whites own all the land in 1913? They owned all the land because they took it from the indigenous tribes." And that type of rhetoric where people hear that, like, well, the whites took our land, and now we need to take it back. But the actual history is a lot more complex than the way he paints it. because the Cape Colony, which is the western part of South Africa, it's a Mediterranean climate. The crops grow in the winter, not the summer. And so the Bantu ethnic group, that's like the major black ethnic group in sub-Saharan Africa, they never settled there. Their crops don't grow there. They grow squash and other things that grow the summertime. They lived on the other side of the country. So the Cape was mostly empty except for some the Khoikhoi tribe, which is like a nomadic hunter-gatherer society, and their population was never big. And so when the Dutch showed up there, they have this, they've got Mediterranean crops from Europe that grow really well there. There's no one there except for a few hunter-gatherers who don't grow crops anyway. They established a colony. And for like 200 years, that colony existed more or less apart from the black tribes in South Africa, except for now and then they'd get in some wars or battles with the Khoikhoi over grazing rights. But that was about it. You just had these Dutch and some British and the Khoikhoi who had their disputes. But the really big racial violence didn't happen in South Africa till King Shaka Zulu decided to expand the Zulu tribe's emperor and kill like 2 million people, conquering all these tribes on the other side of South Africa. So then they started running into this land they'd never lived in before because of the climate. And then they're made conflict with the Dutch and the British. The Dutch had tried to negotiate peace with Shaka's successor, but he pulled a pretty Machiavellian trick on them by inviting their emissaries to a peace meeting and then clubbing them to death. And so the war got worse until basically the British Empire got involved and conquered both the Dutch Cape Colony and the Zulu Kingdom and put it into one country. And that's kind of the environment where apartheid came from, is that you've got two separate nations who'd been at war, both in the same area, that you're just trying to manage and keep conflict down by keeping them separate. And so that's been the original sin argument. I mean, there's definitely a lot of historical baggage on both sides that needs to be cut through here. Yeah. But the idea that like white Europeans showed up in South Africa and just started taking land from blacks is really oversimplistic, as a lot of the Dutch farmers were farming land that was empty because the Zulus killed everybody who lived there before.
Huh. That's quite amazing. So looking at the way the policies are, they're talking about implementing this right now, you talked about just what happened in Zimbabwe and some of the possibilities, even just looking at the murder rate within South Africa over the last, 20, 30 years has been quite high because of the tensions over land ownership and farm attacks that have been very high over that period. So you're looking at a potentially quite explosive situation here. Put it in prophetic context for us, why we would be watching South Africa to see what happens here, and just the racial tension there, how this is something that we need to be viewing in a broader context.
Right. Well, our longtime listeners or anyone who's read Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, knows that the Dutch and the British are descended from the lost 10 tribes of Israel. And there is a prophecy, many prophecies in the Bible about some of the troubles and problems that will come on the nations of Israel in the end time because they've turned away from God. One of them I quote in this article goes into Ezekiel 7, where it says, "Make a chain, for the land is full of bloody crimes, and the city is full of violence. Wherefore I will bring the worst of the heathen, and they shall possess their houses." And I know that word heathen can be kind of emotionally charged sometimes, but it basically just means someone who's not Israelite in the context of when Ezekiel was writing. So this is a prophecy about that, like, okay, well, if these Israelite peoples turn away from my law and they lose my protection, then you will have these people of other ethnic groups that you're going to come into conflict with, and they are going to take your houses, which is, in South Africa's case, is exactly what is happening.
Literally.
You've got And not to, like I said, slur all black South Africans as heathen, but I mean, the ones that burn old ladies definitely act like it. So, and I mean, and these are the worst, the worst of the heathen, heathen just being a non-Israelite ethnic group, and the worst of the heathen being the ones that are willing to crucify people on tables to steal your house. And that is literally what is happening in South Africa, where people are being subjected to terrorist attacks and having their houses stolen. And there is a need for land reform in South Africa. I mean, the Bible talks about a time after the tribulation when everyone will have their own vine and fig tree.
Yeah.
And so I've been to the shanty towns in South Africa, and there's definitely people living in corrugated aluminum houses who could use a vine and fig tree.
Right.
But unriddling the situation and how to get that fixed is complicated, and just, taking land from those who know how to farm it and giving it to those who don't is going to lead to what happened in Zimbabwe, where your agricultural sector just crashes. Or as happening in South Africa, if you just use the type of rhetoric that glosses over all the historical complexities and said, like, well, these white people are descendants of people who stole your stuff, so go steal it back, is going to lead towards like what you've had in South Africa, where you're had. Well, a conservative estimate is 3,000 white farmers murdered so far, compared to only 24 in Zimbabwe or so.
Hmm. Excellent analysis. I appreciate that. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about farm seizures in South Africa and the potential for policy of simply taking land from white farm owners without compensation being implemented. He's written an article that you can find on thetrumpet.com. The title of it is South African President Pledges to Take Land from White Farmers. Go check it out. Thanks very much, Andrew.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Ever since the mass shooting in Parkland, Florida last month, debate in the United States over gun control has gotten very heated. There is an aspect of this story that is being mostly overlooked, and I'd like to look at it here, and that is the role of drugs in these tragedies. In so many of these mass shooting cases, we find that the murderer was on psychiatric medications. The published side effects of these drugs include suicidal and homicidal ideation, which means these drugs are known to put ideas in people's minds about killing themselves or other people. For example, Paxil is a popular antidepressant, and the known adverse drug reactions, according to the FDA-approved label on this drug, include mania, insomnia, anxiety, agitation, confusion, amnesia, depression, paranoid reaction, psychosis, hostility, delirium, hallucinations, abnormal thinking, depersonalization, and a lack of emotion, among other reactions. This is not uncommon. A lot of these drugs tend to have these kinds of side effects, and they're known side effects and they're published side effects. Nicholas Cruz was 19 years old. The Miami Herald reported his aunt saying she believed he was on medication, quote, to deal with his emotional fragility. And you see the same story in so many of these cases. I'm going to give you some quotes from an article titled Media Ignoring One Crucial Factor in Florida School Shooting. This is by David Kupalian, and I've followed this man's writing for years. He's a very good journalist. He works for WND.com. And he writes this: this is strikingly similar to reports right after the 2013 school massacre in Newtown, Connecticut, when Mark and Louise Tambusquillo, family friends of shooter Adam Lanza and his mother, were interviewed on CBS's 60 Minutes, during which Louise told correspondent Scott Pelley, "I know he was on medication and everything, but she homeschooled him at home because he couldn't deal with the school classes sometimes, so she just homeschooled Adam at home, and that was her life." And she told ABC News, "I knew he was on medication, but that's all I know." Now, that's something that a journalist should follow up on. You know, what medication was he on? What are the side effects of that medication? And considering that it's known in so many cases to include this kind of thinking and this kind of behavior, well, Mr. Kupalian does just that. He follows up, or at least he connects several dots in several of these cases. He says, "Fact, a disturbing number of perpetrators of school shootings and similar mass murderers in our modern era were either on or just recently coming off of psychiatric medications. A few of the most high-profile examples out of many others include Columbine mass killer Eric Harris was taking Luvox. This is a widely prescribed type of antidepressant drug. You remember that Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, they shot this is 1999, they killed 12 students and a teacher. They wounded 24 other people before they killed themselves. Luvox manufacturer Solvay Pharmaceuticals concedes that during short-term controlled clinical trials, 4% of children and youth taking Luvox, that's 1 in 25, developed mania, a dangerous and violence-prone mental derangement characterized by extreme excitement and delusion. Another example, Patrick Purdy went on a schoolyard shooting rampage in Stockton, California in 1989. The 25-year-old Purdy, who murdered 5 children and wounded 30, had been on amitriptyline, an antidepressant, as well as the antipsychotic drug Thorazine. Another example, Kip Kinkle, 15, murdered his parents in 1998 and the next day went to his school, Thurston High in Springfield, Oregon, and opened fire on his classmates, killing 2 and wounding 22 others. He had been prescribed both Prozac and Ritalin. Paducah, Kentucky, remember in late 1997, 14-year-old Michael Carniel traveled to Heath High School and started shooting students in a prayer meeting taking place in the school's lobby, killing 3 and leaving another paralyzed. Carniel reportedly was on Ritalin. In 2005, 16-year-old Jeff Wise, living on Minnesota's Red Lake Indian Reservation, shot and killed 9 people and wounded 5 others before killing himself. Wise had been taking Prozac. Another example, Kurt Danish, 18, shot his own father to death in 1996, a little more than 2 weeks after starting on Prozac. Danish's description of his own mental emotional state at the time of the murder is chilling. He said this, "I didn't realize I did it until after it was done. This might sound weird, but it felt like I had no control of what I was doing, like I was just left there holding a gun." And the final example that I'll give you from this article, Andrea Yates, one of the most heartrending crimes in modern history, drowned all 5 of her children, aged 7 years down to 6 months, in a bathtub, insisting inner voices commanded her to kill her children. She had become increasingly psychotic over the course of several years. At her 2006 murder retrial, Yates' longtime friend Debbie Holmes testified, "She asked me if I thought Satan could read her mind and if I believed in demon possession." And Dr. George Ringholtz, after evaluating Yates for 2 days, recounted an experience she had after the birth of her first child. This doctor said what she described was feeling a presence, Satan, telling her to take a knife and stab her son, Noah. And he added that her delusion at the time of the bathtub murders was not only that she had to kill her children to save them, but that Satan had entered her and that she had to be executed in order to kill Satan. Yates had been taking the antidepressant Effexor. Now, November 2005, more than 4 years after Yates drowned her children, the manufacturer of Effexor, Wyeth Pharmaceuticals, quietly added homicidal ideation to the drug's list of rare adverse events. The Medical Accountability Network, a private nonprofit focused on medical ethics issues, publicly criticized Wyeth, saying Effexor's homicidal ideation risk wasn't well publicized and that Wyeth failed to send letters to doctors or issue warning labels announcing the change. Now, what does rare mean in the phrase rare adverse events? The FDA defines it as occurring in less than one in 1,000 people. But that year, 19.2 million prescriptions for Effexor were filled in the United States. So statistically, that means that you may have thousands of Americans experiencing, quote, homicidal ideation, murderous thoughts as a result of taking this one brand of antidepressant drug. This is Kupalian. He says, Effexor is Wyeth's best-selling drug, by the way, which in one recent year brought in over $3 billion in sales, accounting for almost a fifth of the company's annual revenues. This is big, big business. And right now, everyone is so focused on gun control, they're not even considering the possible role that these popular drugs might be having. Kupalian, he talks about just how effective these drug companies are at settling cases out of court when these kinds of things happen. They're very eager to try to prevent there being any link shown between these horrific acts and the drugs themselves, and they shell out millions of dollars to plaintiffs in order to keep these things from hitting the courts. Nevertheless, he writes here, remember, every single SSRI antidepressant, that stands for selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, it's a certain kind of antidepressant, every one of these sold in the United States of America today, no matter what brand or manufacturer, bears a black box FDA warning label, the government's most serious drug warning, of increased risks of suicidal thinking and behavior, known as suicidality, in young adults ages 18 to 24. This is on the box for these drugs. He says, common sense tells us that where there are suicidal thoughts, especially in a very, very angry person, homicidal thoughts may not be far behind. Indeed, the mass shooters we are describing often take their own lives when police show up, having planned their suicide ahead of time. So this definitely is an aspect of this story that is underreported. It's not being looked at the way that it should be. Kupalian says this, whether we like to admit it or not, it is undeniable that when certain people living on the edge of sanity take psychiatric medications, those drugs can and occasionally do push them over the edge into violent madness. Now, why would that be the case? We have to understand why. It doesn't make sense in and of itself. There is a spiritual dimension to this. And if you've been following the Trumpet and Trumpet Radio, you know that our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, has emphasized the passage in Revelation 12 about Satan being cast down and his demons with him. And it says that these demons are very active in the world. Their influence is spreading. Satan is growing angrier the shorter his time gets. So when people go on these types of drugs, they are opening themselves up to influence from these evil spirit beings. You don't have people thinking about picking up guns and murdering people by the dozens just in and of themselves. That doesn't come from nowhere. It comes from evil spiritual forces. So as Americans focus on gun control, they're ignoring the real causes of these horrific tragedies. The Apostle Paul warned us not to be ignorant of Satan's devices, lest we become vulnerable to them. And that's exactly why these evil influences are going to continue to increase.
Time for today's last word.
Scientists in recent years have accumulated evidence showing that specific features about our planet must be extremely fine-tuned in order to support life. One obvious example is the Earth's distance from the sun. It is just right to keep temperatures here hospitable, somewhere between negative 30 degrees and 120 degrees Fahrenheit. If we were further away from the sun, we would freeze. If we were any closer, we would roast. Each year, science recognizes more of these finely tuned features that allow for life here. In 1988, Dr. Hugh Ross's team of astronomy researchers counted 15 features that had to be just so for any life to survive. By 1991, they'd counted a couple more. By 1995, they'd come to see yet 9 more features that had to be exactly right. They kept researching and finding more features that any significant change in any one of these conditions, and none of us would be here. Now, they've since found over 140 features, all perfectly lined up so life can exist on this planet. And these features have to align precisely for any physical life to survive, even just a single-celled organism, for an advanced human civilization to exist. The features that scientists have realized must be in place are far, far more numerous. In his book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is, Dr. Ross says it would take at least 10 to the 700th power times more fine-tuning precision for a high-tech civilization like ours than for just single-cell life that survives for 90 days or less. What that means is our planet is an incomprehensibly fine-tuned precision machine. Every one of these features exponentially increases the impossibility that life just happened to come about here without deliberate design. This is strong evidence that there had to be a designer. Did you realize that most of the universe in its present form is uninhabitable? It's too hot or too cold, too dense or too vacuous, too dark or too bright. It has too much radiation or too few of the heavy elements required for life. Gravitational forces are too intense. Environments are too unstable. Scientists have come to recognize just how remarkable and fortuitous our cosmic location is. We're far enough from the center of the Milky Way so we're not bombarded by radiation. We're nowhere near dangerous star clusters or quasars or nebulae. We're right next to this very stable star called the Sun, and a whole host of factors make our planet's position just perfect. Peter Ward and Donald Brownlee wrote a book called Rare Earth, and they wrote, "Earth is quite a charmed planet." And it is charmed, quote-unquote, in more than just its location. Earth is 7,913.1 miles in diameter, and even though it just floats in space, it weighs about 6,000 million, million, million tons. Scientists have learned several reasons why this is the ideal size. For example, if it were any smaller, an atmosphere would be impossible, like the planet Mercury. If it were larger, we couldn't live in its atmosphere. It would be like Jupiter's. Humans need 27 elements to live: hydrogen, oxygen, carbon, calcium, iron, sodium, potassium, and so on. Earth has just the right mix of all of them, with a rich abundance of rare but vital heavy elements in its core and sprinkled throughout its crust and mantle. Earth's distance from both the sun and the moon are also perfect to ensure it has a stable, predictable orbit with 24-hour days. Thus, the planet doesn't get too hot or too cold. The entire surface of Earth is properly warmed and cooled every day. If, for example, the sun were smaller and Earth had to be closer to it in order to receive enough warmth for life, the planet's rotation would be dangerously affected by the sun's gravity. The same side of the Earth could be locked into facing the sun at all times, the way the moon is to the Earth. That would bake half the planet and freeze the other half. Thanks to the fact that we have one large moon, and its mass compared to the Earth is an incredible 50 times greater than any other moon-planet combination that we know of, Earth is tilted at a nice, gentle 23.5-degree angle. Planets that have no moons, or a relatively small moon, have a rotation axis that tilts very chaotically. Without our moon, Earth would experience catastrophic climate changes. But as it is, that tilt gives us predictable, pleasant seasonal changes that provide variety and facilitate annual food production all over the planet. These are extraordinary features. Recognizing this, scientists have concocted elaborate explanations of how they all came about through indiscriminate natural forces over billions of years. But the book of Job provides a more plausible explanation. In Job 38, God provides an extraordinary picture of a moment in the universe's history when he built the earth. There God asks Job, "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if you have understanding." Our planet didn't come to inhabit its perfect place in the cosmos haphazardly. God says in this verse that he actively set the earth in this precise location. "Who determined earth's measurements?" God asks Job. "Or who stretched the line upon it?" Our planet's size and extraordinary elemental composition are not the product of arbitrary forces. They were measured precisely, surveyed precisely, perfectly prepared to suit God's purposes. God also asks, "Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened, or who laid the cornerstone thereof?" The physical forces that anchor our planet and stabilize it, so crucial to its being able to host life, aren't luck. Our Creator established them. Everyone who sees that kind of meticulous and stunning handiwork should be shouting God's praises. After hearing God's speech, Job was humbled. His appreciation for God's creative genius and power multiplied, and his perspective on himself had shrunk to more realistic proportions. Today's scientific revelations are telling us the same basic truths, confirming the biblical record. Surely we should be similarly awed and inspired. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests on the program today, Richard Palmer and Andrew Miller. Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Nathaniel Hawthorne: "Happiness is a butterfly, which when pursued is always just beyond your grasp, but which, if you will sit down quietly, may alight upon you." Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.